Beloved Book One. One night, Issan was in attendance on Hayakujo, sitting till late in the quietness of the mountain temple. "Who are you?" Hayakujo asked. "Ryu," replied Issan. "Rake in the fireplace," instructed Hayakujo. Issan did as he was told and said, "I find no embers left." Hayakujo took up the tongs and, raking deep down, brought up a tiny burning ember, which he showed to Issan and said, "Just this, you see?" Issan was suddenly enlightened. He bowed deeply and related his point of realization to Hayakujo, who said, "You have reached a crossroads on the Buddha nature. You should observe time and causation. When the time comes, you will realize it, just like remembering something you have forgotten. It is not obtained from others. Therefore, when you are enlightened, your original nature manifests itself. Now you have attained it, carefully cultivate it."
Manisha, today we start a new series of talks on Zen, particularly on Master Issan. The name of the series will give you an indication what kind of man Issan was. The title of the series is Issan, No Footprints in the Blue Sky. He was as great a master as one can be, but has not left behind him great scriptures. Neither great commentaries. Issan functioned exactly as Buddha had said. That an authentic master will disappear in the blue sky like a bird, leaving no footprints. Why this idea of leaving no footprints? It has great implications in it. It means a great master does not create following. He does not make a path for everybody to follow. He flies in the sky, gives you a longing of flying, and disappears into the blueness of the sky, creating an urge in you what it is like to disappear into the ultimate. Issan followed exactly what Buddha has said. He is a great master, but almost forgotten. Who remembers people who have not created great following, who have not made organized religions, who have not chosen their successors, who have not made their religion a politics, a power in the material world? Isan did nothing of it. He simply lived silently. Of course, thousands of disciples were attracted towards him, but it was not his fault. You cannot blame him for it. Just the magnetic force that he has become by self-disappearance into enlightenment. The light was sown to far away lands, and those who had eyes started moving towards a small place hidden in the forest where Isan lived. Slowly, slowly, thousands of disciples were living in the forest, and Isan has not called a single one. They have come on their own, and remember the difference. When you come on your own, you come totally. When you are called, there is a reluctance, a fear. Perhaps you will be dominated. But when you come on your own, you have lived the life, you have known the meaninglessness of it. You are coming out of a great understanding that life has nothing to offer. You are coming with your wholeness and totality, and with an urgency, because nobody knows tomorrow you may be here on the earth or not. Death can knock on your doors any moment. It is unpredictable. It rarely comes warning the person that I am coming. Once in a while it has happened in the stories. So the next moment is not certain. All that you have got is this moment. So don't disperse your consciousness. Concentrate it on this moment. If you want really to know the ultimate source of being and the tremendous blessings of it, this single moment is enough. Don't follow anybody's footprints. Truth cannot be borrowed, neither the path that somebody else has trodden. You have to enter into a virgin land of your own inner space, where nobody can in any way enter. The deeper you go, more alone you are. Friends and foes families and the society slowly, slowly all drop by as you are dropping your mind. Once the mind is finished, you are left in total aloneness. And this aloneness is such a great joy that remember, it is not loneliness. Loneliness is a desire for the other. Aloneness is a fulfillment unto oneself. One is enough. One is the whole universe. So whatsoever the dictionaries say is absolutely wrong. They make aloneness and loneliness synonymous. That is not true. As far as existential experience is concerned, Isan lived alone. But his aloneness became such a glaring splendor that people came on their own towards him, towards this great silence, this immense beauty of truth. This man has reached home. Just to be in his presence. Perhaps you may find your way also. He is not going to give you the way. But in his presence, many things are possible. One, you will become certain that the experience of enlightenment is not an imagination of poets or a philosophical system of philosophers. It is an authentic realization. You can feel it. You can almost touch it. And if your heart is open, you can see your heart dancing with joy. Your whole life near a man like Isan will take wings. So thousands came, but Isan has not given any guidance. Therefore, I have chosen the name from Buddha's statement. Isan, no footprints in the blue sky. He just fluttered into the sky, attracting those who have forgotten their wings, provoking, challenging those who have forgotten their sky, their freedom, and then disappeared into the faraway sky, into the blueness, leaving no footprints, but leaving a tremendous urge to go to those dimensions where you are no more. Your being no more is the ultimate realization of truth. You are the barrier, you are the problem, you are the only problem. As you melt away, something in you which is eternal, which you cannot call yourself, something in you which belongs to the whole cosmos starts appearing. Only dust was it that you used to call yourself. Before I take the sutras, a little introductory note about the biography of Isan. Isan Reyu, otherwise known as Kuisan Lingyu, lived from 771 to 853. He left home at 15 to become a monk, studying under the local Vinaya master in what is today the Fujian province. Everything that may seem non-essential, but I feel it has a great meaning to be understood. He left home at 15, a totally different world was there, a totally different urge in humanity. What is a 15-year boy? But the urge must have been so spread and so thick in the atmosphere that even if a 15-year-old boy is intelligent enough, he will catch the fire. It is said that there are people who go on repeating the same foolish act again and again, but never learn anything. That's why history repeats. It is because of the idiots. Otherwise, there is no reason for history to repeat. It will always bring a new dawn, not an old, rotten, lived, finished completely. But history has to repeat because idiots go on and on repeating themselves. And they are the makers of history. It is unintelligence that makes it possible for history to repeat. The saying is that the unintelligent will not learn from his own mistakes, but the intelligent can even learn from others' mistakes. And the man who can learn from others' mistakes has a great potential. At the age of 15, he must have learned from others' mistakes. He must have watched carefully his parents, his neighbors, his teachers, their lifeless life, their meaningless wandering, no sense of direction. accept misery and suffering, all that they have is some promising hope that may be fulfilled in the future. Perhaps in the next life, or perhaps in paradise. But this life is going to be a suffering. It cannot be otherwise. It is the nature of life, and they have accepted it. At the age of 15, he left the home. He is not going to commit the same mistakes that everybody else is committing. He left home at 15 to become a monk, studying under the local Vinaya master. Vinaya master is only a rabbi, a pandit, a learned scholar. Vinaya is the name of the Buddhist scriptures. The very word Vinaya means humbleness, because Buddha teaches that to be humble is to be close to the nature. His whole scriptures, and they are many, have all been called Vinaya scriptures, because their fundamental teaching from different directions is the same: just to be nobody, just to be ready to disappear into the blueness of the sky without leaving any footprints. Obviously, he was in search. He went to study under the local Vinaya master. A 15-year-old boy does not know where to go. So whoever was in the locality, the most famous and learned scholar, he went to him. He was ordained at Hangzhou at the age of 23. Being ordained means now he is taking an absolute commitment to find himself. He is declaring to the world that help me not to get astray. It is an announcement on his part of his innermost longing. But now it becomes socially known that he is a seeker, and in those days seekers were helped by the society in every possible way, by food, by clothes, by shelter. The whole society seemed to be running around a central longing of becoming a Buddha. If circumstances don't allow you now, people were waiting for the right circumstances so they can escape in the blue sky. Today we are very small in the sense our desires are for money, our desires are for beautiful houses, our desires are for success in the world, fame, name, political power. According to the spiritual scale, we have fallen certainly. Those old days, people were poor with no science, no technology, but still they were superior in the sense that their whole longing was to search the meaning of life. And anybody who is searching the meaning of life, at least if you cannot go so far, you can help. Helping anybody who is searching for truth was in itself considered a great virtue, and I accept the idea. A society should live. Of course, everybody cannot be a monk unless my strategy is followed. But it is a little complicated to remain a witness in your ordinary life. It is easier to be a witness if you live in a monastery or if you are a monk and you don't deal with ordinary life. You don't earn any money, you don't have any power, you live just on begging. Just one meal a day. And because the society was so poor, that Buddha has told his ardent monks that you should collect your one meal. Only one meal was allowed in 24 hours from seven houses, just piece by piece. So you are not a burden on anybody. Now just a monk going to beg from seven houses is not a burden, because every house is giving him so small piece. Because of this fact that the seekers and searchers should not be involved in business and waste their time, their total energy should be directed to a single point, their central being. Society should help them, because their rising consciousness is going to help the society also. You may know, you may not know. The few Buddhas that have happened in the history have raised your consciousness without your knowing. Without them, you will be still in the jungles. You have not done anything, but the atmosphere has been changed by each Buddha. He has given so much in abundance that don't think that a piece of bread is enough to pay him. We cannot pay him in any way. His contribution to human consciousness is so much, and his carefulness. Buddha told, take your one meal from seven houses and never stay in one village more than 3 days. Go on moving, because remaining in one village, you may become a kind of drag to people. Every day they have to give to you leave before they become in any way annoyed by you. And it is a great psychological insight that it takes people to become familiar with persons or places 4 days. If you change your house, it will take 4 days for you to become at ease with the new house. Before the village becomes familiar, you should leave. You are an outsider. You are not allowed to become familiar, friendly. You have to remain a stranger. You have chosen the path of being a stranger. Ordained at Hangcha at the age of 23, he traveled to Jiangxi and became a disciple of Hayakujo. He found the master. The learned teachers that he must have come across could not fulfill his appetite. They could not give him what he was asking for. He was not asking for more knowledge. He was asking for who is the one who knows. They were interesting to inquire into the very structure of the knower, of the witness. Naturally, the scholars cannot do that. They can quote great quotations, but they cannot radiate the Buddhahood. They are not an argument for their own quotations. They are not a support to their own learnedship. Their whole life is so ordinary, it does not show the grace and the beauty and the blissfulness of which they are talking. So any intelligent seeker will soon realize that this man has only words, but he does not know the meaning. He is carrying a dead corpse, but he is not aware that the person is dead. All the scholars of the world are grave diggers. They dig deeply into graves and find bones of all kinds of people, but they never dig deep into themselves. They may find the bones of Buddha. They even worship the bones when they find. In Sri Lanka, in Kandy, they have a great temple devoted to a teeth of Buddha, which every scientific exploration has proved that it is not a tooth of a human being. It is too big. It can only be of an animal. But who cares about it? Kandy attracts in Sri Lanka more pilgrimage than any other temple, because it has a tooth of Gautam Buddha. Scholars sometimes seem to be so stupid. There was a hair in Srinagar, Kashmir, thought to be of Hazrat Muhammad's. Mohammedans worshipped it because that was the only relic left from the body of Muhammad. Nobody knows whose hair it was, and there is no way to prove that it is Muhammad's hair. But few years back, it was stolen. And then there was great fuss all over the world amongst the Mohammedans. That mask, Hazrat Baal, Baal means hair, even the Baal is to be called Hazrat. Osho, reverend hair. And it was such a difficult situation, riots started happening because Mohammedans thought certainly it must be the Hindus. And Hindus are in a very small minority in Kashmir. And even though Hindu leaders in Kashmir declared again and again that we are not concerned at all with your religion, but it was to no avail. And finally, the Indian Prime Minister Jawaharlal Nehru has to send the chief of the armies with a great number of soldiers to surround the mosque and somehow manage the hair. Now, how somehow you can manage? Somehow it was managed. Somebody's hair has been put in the tube which was empty. Now everybody was happy that the hair has been found. What kind of stupidity, what you will do with the hair? If you find the whole head of Muhammad, that too will not help. But people are concerned with absolute absurdities so much involved, and this is because of the scholars, the so-called learned, who provoke the masses . Isan must have learned from one teacher to another teacher. He went on to look for a man who is essential, who is not a Buddhist but a Buddha, who does not believe in any hypotheses, who knows. And when he came to Hayakujo, immediately something transpired. He found the master. That was the way how students, disciples, devotees went on searching from one monastery to another monastery, from one monk to another monk. There are no visible signs, no certificates that who is enlightened. You have to find it with your own heart, in whose presence your heart starts dancing. It is an inner finding, in whose presence your whole life becomes light, in whose presence certainly your mind is gone as if it was a shadow, and utter silence falls over you. When he came to Hayakujo, he immediately became a disciple. Later, Hayakujo sent Isan to Mount E as abbot. Isan lived as a wild hermit initially, but by and by began to attract disciples. They finally increased to 1,000 in number. Isan taught at Mount E for more than 40 years. This is just a small biographical note. Now the sutras. Beloved Bhagwan, one night Isan was in attendance on Hayakujo, sitting till late in the night. Quietness of the mountain temple. Who are you? Hayakujo asked. Reyu, replied Isan. Rake in the fireplace, instructed Hayakujo. Isan did as he was told and said, I find no embers left. The fire is completely gone. There is no more any embers left. Hayakujo took up the tongs and raking deep down, brought up a tiny burning ember, which he showed to Isan and said, just this, you see, you did not go deep enough. In a silent night on a mountain temple, everything a master does has a purpose. If he has asked to find if there is any fire left in the wood, night is becoming colder, just find it out. Ordinarily, it is an insignificant act. And Isan did as he was told, but said, I find no embers left. The fire is completely gone out. Hayakujo took up the tongs. This is the way Zen is a direct teaching, no words. Hayakujo took up the tongs and raking deep down, brought up a tiny burning ember, which he showed to Isan and said, just this, you see, you did not go deep enough. Isan was suddenly enlightened, because this was the exact situation in his meditations. He was going, but not deep enough to find the fire of life. Immediately, without saying anything, enlightenment is not being talked about, but seeing Hayakujo's action, going deep, he has found an ember. He must have gone deep into himself. He has been meditating, but must have not been going deep enough to find the living fire. Isan was suddenly enlightened. It is very difficult for rational people to understand how enlightenment can be sudden. It is sudden if you understand how Zen masters create out of every situation some indication which cannot be said in words. In words he has said again and again, go deep. But only it can be said. It all depends whether you go deep or not. He has to make it a very clear-cut existential situation to show him that he has not been going deep enough. And a simple thing, finding the ember made his son go as deep as possible within himself in that silent night. He found his inner fire. He became enlightened. It looks sudden. It is not so sudden. Years of studying, years of meditating. But at the right moment, the Master gives you a situation which will indicate you what is missing. He was not daring to go to the very center. Otherwise, how you can miss the living fire? You are alive. How can you miss your divinity? How can you miss your Buddha? Isan was suddenly enlightened. He bowed deeply and related his point of realization to Hayakujo, who said, "You have reached a crossroads on the Buddha nature. You should observe time and causation. Even though he has become enlightened, he has to give roots to his enlightenment. Otherwise, it will remain just only a far away glimpse, soon forgotten, or maybe remembered only as an echo, miles away. The sudden flowering within you, now you should water carefully. Now you should keep watch around the clock that your treasure is increasing, that your inner sky is spreading wider and wider, that your wings are growing, that the time for the ultimate flight to the ocean of the dewdrop is coming closer." Hayakujo said to him, "You have reached a crossroads on the Buddha nature. You should observe time and causation. Now be watchful." What has caused your enlightenment is an ordinary mundane thing. You should remember now that going deeper, suddenly you became enlightened. You can go still more deeper. There is, in fact, no boundary line where you have to stop. You can go so deep that you become the depth. Only then your enlightenment has grown roots. Now it cannot be destroyed. It is no more a seasonal flower. When the time comes, you will realize it, just like remembering something you have forgotten. What you have seen today is the first glimpse which has put you on a crossroad. You can go astray still. The other roads are available. Now be careful. What has caused it? Going deeper. So go on deeper and deeper and deeper. Never stop before you yourself become the depth. Just an empty abyss. That is the time when spring comes to your being. You will realize it then that you have not achieved anything. It is just like remembering something you have forgotten. It has always been there. So it is not something new that you have achieved. It is something that you have forgotten so long ago that you don't have any idea when you forgot it. And now you have remembered. The moment your enlightenment becomes just a remembrance, it becomes your very breathing, it becomes your very heartbeat, then you don't need any meditation, then your whole life is meditation. Without any effort, effortlessly you are a Buddha. If there is any effort, that means something is missing. When the Buddha is natural, even in your sleep you are a Buddha. Waking, working, whatever you do, your fragrance of Buddhahood will be there around you. But this will happen only when you have reached to the ultimate depth. And the realization is not taken as an achievement, but only as a remembrance. So you don't start bragging about it, because it is not an achievement. What is there to brag about it? You simply drown yourself into this new, abandoned, forgotten space, which is your very being. And millions of things are going to happen, but you are not the doer. They will be simply happening because your presence has reached to such depth. When your witnessing has reached to the ultimate depth, flowers will start blossoming. lotuses will open. A dawn has come to you. You are reborn. You were dead. Now you are alive. A new life spreads all over you and brings great beauty and truth and grace. It is not obtained from others. Therefore, when you are enlightened, your original nature manifests itself. Now you have attained it, carefully cultivate it. This is a very significant statement of Hayakujo. You cannot cultivate enlightenment. That will be phony. You can walk like a Buddha. You can manage to sit in the lotus posture. It may take a little time for you. The bones and particularly people coming from the west will find it more difficult. Colder countries devise chairs. Hotter countries have no problem to sit on the floor. In colder countries, to sit on the floor was difficult. So if Buddha is sitting in the lotus posture, that does not mean that you have to sit in the lotus posture only, then you will become Buddha. You can practice it. There are many idiots who are doing unnecessarily torturing yourself. Buddhahood is your nature. So you cannot cultivate it. But what Hayakujo means is totally different. He is saying, now that you have attained it, carefully cultivate it. This attainment is so new, it is possible to fall back into darkness. It is possible to start thinking again that it may have been an imagination. All kinds of possibilities are there. The glimpse that you have got is very fresh and young, and your past of ignorance is very long. 4 million years, it has a weight. This new insight can be destroyed by that weight. This new flower that has blossomed in you can be crushed by a mountainous past. You cannot cultivate enlightenment if you have not attained it. So first attain it. It looks strange. First attain the glimpse, and then protect, cultivate, then make arrangements that the past does not take over you. Because the weight of the old is very great. And the new is always delicate. So remember, Hayakujo is not saying to cultivate enlightenment. He is saying first get it and then be careful in every possible way to protect it, to refine it, to go deeper into it, to find more roots to it. The real work starts when you have become enlightened. All that work that you have done before enlightenment looks like very tiny effort. The great effort starts with your first glimpse of enlightenment. You can fall from it. The whole past will be pulling you backwards. The whole past will be saying to you that this is all imagination. You have to be very alert that the past is your enemy and this fresh sprout, this new flower, so small and so fragile but so beautiful, that if you can manage to protect it, soon it will become your eternity. Soon it will become your nature. Then there is no effort. When Zen masters say effortlessness, they mean to the state when your enlightenment is well rooted, now there is no need of any effort. Now you can be relaxed and at ease. It will grow on its own accord. It will bring much foliage and many flowers and many blessings. Sekiso wrote, the Dharma spring has never run dry. It is flowing even now. A single drop has fallen and spread far and deep. Don't be caught by the decorations at the edge and the wall around it. In the dead of night, the moon shines from the middle of the pond. What Sekiso is saying, is very symbolic. The Dharma spring, the spring when those who are ripe become suddenly full of flowers, the dark night ends and the morning has come. The Dharma spring has never run dry. He is saying, remember, the dharma spring has never run dry. It always comes as it used to come in Gautam Buddha's time or even before. It is part of eternal nature. Just you have to be ready to catch the train. The train always comes. Mostly, either you reach to the railway station before the train has come, or you reach after the train has left. You always find a flat platform, sad and frustrated, you go back home. I have heard 3 professors were discussing very heartily about some philosophical point on the railway station. The two has come to say goodbye to the other who was going to be transferred to another university. They got so involved in the discussion, they forgot that the train stops only 3 minutes there. As the train started moving, still they were not aware. Suddenly one of them saw, and they all 3 ran to catch the train. In the last compartment, only 2 could manage. One was left, and he was standing there so sad that a porter who was looking what was happening said that, why you are so sad? Soon there will be coming a second train. Just within few hours you will meet your friend. He said, that is not the point. I am the one who was supposed to go. They had come only to see me off. Now everything has become a mess. But in a hurry it can happen. The dharma spring has never run dry. It always is available. Just you are not ready. The whole responsibility has to be taken by you on your own shoulders. The existence is as in favor of Buddhas as it has always been. But you are not even looking at it. You are not preparing. You are not even witnessing that when it comes, in fact, it never comes. It is always there. You come to it. Deeper your witnessing, And suddenly you find a tremendous reality flooding you in your very innermost center. It is still waiting. The Dharma spring has never run dry. It is flowing even now. A single drop has fallen and spread far and wide, far and deep. The ocean of Dharma spring is always ready to absorb you. It has always space for you. You are always welcome. Nobody has been rejected by Dharma nature. Even if a single drop has fallen, it has spread all over the ocean, far and deep. Don't be caught by the decorations at the edge and the wall around it. In the dead of night, the moon shines from the middle of the pond. We are all attracted by decorations, by the non-essentials. A lake may have a wall around it with beautiful statues, sculpture, architectural designs, and you may get so much involved in those decorations that you may fail to see that the pond is reflecting the moon exactly in the middle. This is just symbolic. It is saying that the existential truth is always shining in the middle of all this whole world of decorations, powers. All kinds of desires, motivations, longings. Amongst this whole crowd, exactly in the middle, exactly in the center of your being, the full moon is reflected. Don't get caught into decorations. Manisha has asked, "Beloved Bhagwan, I have heard you say that the enlightened ones, like birds, leave no footprints behind them. Yet people like Ishan touch our consciousness hundreds of years after they have died. Could you please comment?" Manisha, touching your consciousness is another matter. To the open consciousness, all the Buddhas are available this very moment. To celebrate you, to take you into the new space that you have been avoiding for centuries, But that is not making footprints. It is beyond the capacity of a bird to make footprints in the sky. And the inner world is almost like the sky. It is the inner sky. And the people who have entered into the inner world, they also cannot leave footprints. It is just to say that you cannot follow them from the outside through their words, through their scriptures. You have to go into yourself, and suddenly you will be surprised that you have disappeared and a Buddha has appeared. And you were not following Buddha's footprints. He cannot make. In the sky you cannot write anything. All the scriptures and all the great religions are befooling the masses and exploiting the masses. One has to go within, and all the religions are supporting you to go out towards Jesus, towards Moses, towards Muhammad, towards Buddha. But go outwards. Follow their teachings, follow their commandments, that is what Buddha says, is going astray. No Buddha can leave any footprints, so how you can follow him? Following is simply impossible. You can go only within yourself. You can understand a living Buddha. You can absorb his energy. You can hear his song. You can understand his silence. You can be filled by his presence. But this is not following. This is simply the alchemy of being with a master. You can simply disappear in the silences of the master. But you are not following the footprints. You are going within yourself. You have your own path from the circumference to the center. Now comes the time for Sardar Gurdayal Singh. Poor fellow has to wait so long. And he brings his rainbow. Turban with such care. He used to be just an old hippie. Suddenly he has become a mini guru. And he is enjoying it so much. And directing many. This is called transformation. Ronald Reagan and George Bush go hiking together in the Montana mountains. They have been walking all day discussing the forthcoming presidential election, and Ronald is giving George lots of advice about how to wear his makeup and look good on TV. Suddenly they look up and see a huge grizzly bear coming over the hill towards them. Immediately Bush reaches into his pack and pulls out a pair of running shoes. He then starts taking off his hiking boots and putting on the sneakers. "Hey," says Ronald nervously, "you don't think you can outrun that grizzly bear, do you?" "I don't have to," says Bush with a grin. "I just have to outrun you." Kowalski is returning home from a morning's hunting with his shotgun in one hand and his hunting bag slung over his shoulder. His friend Sloboski sees him across the road and calls out, "Hi, Kowalski, been hunting?" "That's right," replies Kowalski. "Been hunting ducks." "Far out," says Sloboski. "How many did you get?" "Well," replies Kowalski, "if you can guess how many ducks I have got in my bag, I will give you them both." "Ah," says Sloboski, scratching his head. "Three?" Harry and Harriet are a very devoutedly religious couple. They observe all the Christian religious festivals by remaining strictly celibate until the festival is over. during Lent, which lasts for a whole month, they decide to give up sex. They are especially careful. They even sleep in separate rooms to make sure they won't be tempted. Lent finishes at 6 o'clock in the morning on Sunday, and sure enough, at exactly 6 o'clock, Harriet hears a sharp knocking on her bedroom door. "Is that you, Harry?" asks Harriet. "Yes," he cries. "This is your ever-loving husband." "Ah, Harry," giggles Harriet. "I know why you are knocking." "You know why I am knocking?" cries Harriet. "Harry, but you should see with what." This joke was given to me . Somebody must have made it, and when Nirvana told me about the joke, he has made it a Jaina couple. The husband's name was Halwa Bhai and the wife's name was Meva Bhai. And they have a religious festival, Paryushan. So he has made that Paryushan and the whole joke has remained the same. But I told Nirvana, jokes have their roots. You cannot change their context. Now, a Jaina couple, the joke will not be fitting. About Jews, you can say any kind of joke. Their appetite is big enough. Everything fits. But about Hindus, about Jainas, about Buddhists, you cannot just change name. They will be absolutely unfitting because they will not have any natural context. India has no jokes of its own. All the jokes are imported. Fortunately, there is no taxation on importing jokes. You can just change the names to Indian names, but it will not be right. It will not sound right. Even a joke has a certain context, a certain reference. It is not just a joke. You cannot implant it anywhere you like. It has a climate of its own. For example, a Jewish joke cannot be planted to another race, because that joke has a history of its own. Nobody writes jokes, you know. There are not joke writers. From where jokes come? From the wisdom of the fox. Thousands of years, they change many hands, many situations, and then they come to a refinement. Nobody can claim that I am the writer. And never try to change names, because they will look absolutely out of context. If you cannot find to whom the jokes should belong, just put some Jewish names. They are the only people rich enough and for a particular reason they can absorb any joke. They have suffered so much since Moses brought them out of Egypt in search of Israel. Their whole life for these 4,000 years has been that of suffering and suffering and suffering. I have heard about an old Jew dying. Praying to God, his family was surprised what he was saying. He was saying to God that, God, enough is enough. Now you should choose somebody else as your chosen people. This stupid idea that Jews are the chosen people has been the cause of all the suffering. But suffering has to be somehow consoled, some ointment, so many wounds. Jokes have grown in the Jewish context. They had to laugh, otherwise how to forget the agony? How to forget all the suffering that they have passed through? They lost their land. They have got it back just now, 40 years before. Now it is a struggle to keep it. All around they are surrounded by the Mohammedans, and there is no way. I can't see any possibility of their survival there. It is the ugliest and most criminal act of American politicians to give them back Israel, which has been in the hands of Mohammedans. But it was a clever strategy. This way they can get rid of many Jews without killing them. They were doing exactly what Adolf Hitler did. He killed 6 million Jews. Because the problem was, if Jews are the chosen people, then who are the Germans? The conflict was this, that Adolf Hitler thought that his people, the Nordic Germans, are the chosen people of God, and Jews will not agree to that. He finished 6 million Jews. America did the same, but in a more diplomatic way. After the Second World War, he gave Palestine, which was once Israel and has fallen into the hands of Mohammedans. And for centuries, Jews have lived without any land of their own. And I don't think there is any need. Land should disappear, boundaries should disappear. Everybody should be living on the planet. But because after Second World War, Palestine was in the hands of America, they played a very ugly trick. They gave it back not to the Mohammedans, but to the Jews. It is true, it used to belong to Jews centuries before. But now it has been in the hands of the Mohammedans for so long that even the name had changed. It was no more called Israel, it has become Palestine. Under the pressure of American forces, which were holding Palestine, they made it Israel. Nations are not made like that way. Now, thousands of Jews from other countries, particularly America, have moved to Israel. And they are surrounded from all sides from Mohammedans, and for 40 years they have been continuously fighting and being killed. This is the fundamentalist Christian mind which played a very clever trick. And I cannot see any future for Israel. Any day America stops giving arms to them, they are a small island surrounded by millions of Mohammedans they will all will be killed. But America played a game, forced the Jews, and Jews thought that they are being favored by America, and they had a great hope someday to have their own land. So they rushed with all their money, and they are still sending money, the other Jews who have remained behind. So their whole money is being destroyed in Israel. Now they are in such a difficult position, neither they can go back. They have brought everything they had, nor they can see any future that they can live in peace. Every day it is continuous war. Terrorists of all kinds. Nobody is secure. This situation is very rare, that for 4,000 years, on some unfortunate day, Moses brought Jews to Israel. 40 years it took him to find this barren land that he used to call Holy Land. He has to call it Holy Land. Otherwise his followers would have killed him. In 40 years search in the desert, 2/3 of the original members who had come with him died. And he passed Saudi Arabia and Iran. Jews can never forgive him. If he had stopped at Saudi Arabia, they would have been the richest people in the world today. But at that time, nobody knew about the petrol or the oil. So it is not his fault. But one thing is certain, that he is not a great prophet. He could not see, just there below the earth, there was so much petrol and oil. What kind of prophet? And then, finding that it is getting late, he was now 80, and the Holy Land seems to be nowhere. In utter desperation, he simply declared Israel, which is just a barren land, to be the holy place of God, the Holy Land, just to satisfy the followers. Although the followers were not very satisfied, looking at the Holy Land, they said, "My God, and we are the chosen people of God, and this is the Holy Land." Moses escaped by an excuse, saying that a small tribe of the Jews has got lost in the desert. So I am going to find them and bring them back. And he never came. He found them. They were here in Kashmir. And Kashmir looks like a holy land. It is so beautiful, incomparable to any place in the whole earth. Its beauty is superb. Just if he had brought all the Jews to Kashmir, they would have been satisfied that we are certainly the chosen people of God and this is the holy land. That one small tribe that has wandered away from the main caravan of the Jews, found in Kashmir, and they thought that they have come. And they remained in Kashmir. And when Moses came back, his grave is in Kashmir. He lived with them. It is a strange coincidence that Jesus also died in Kashmir. And both the graves are at the same place. Jesus never knew that he is a Christian. He was born a Jew, he lived as a Jew, he proclaimed himself as the last prophet of the Jews, and that was the reason that the Jews crucified him, because they did not want to accept a donkey riding carpenter's son to be their last prophet. It was irritating. So the resurrection is just a story. Jesus was brought down from the cross after 6 hours. Because Jews observe Saturday as a holy day. No work has to be done. So Friday evening, it was only 6 hours that Jesus has been on the cross. They had to bring him down. Because that will be work. And the Jewish cross is a very primitive old type of mechanism. You need at least to hang on it if you want to die 48 hours. Within 48 hours you can change your mind. That's why nobody ever commits suicide on a Jewish cross. Because who can maintain 48 hours the idea of committing suicide? Just within 1 minute or two, and he will say that let us think it over again. What is the hurry? And anyway, I am feeling hungry. After 6 hours, Jesus was a young man, only 33, robust and healthy. He escaped. It was a pure conspiracy between the Roman governor, because Judea was under the Roman Empire. The Romans were not interested in Jews' problems that Jesus is not the prophet or the prophet. It was irrelevant to them. And Pontius Pilate, the governor, has an interview before the crucifixion to see whether this man needs to be crucified. And he found that this man is absolutely innocent, maybe a little nuisance, because just riding on the donkey, followed by 12 idiots who believed in him, that he is the only begotten Son of God, and he has promised those idiots that you will have a special place in the kingdom of God. Naturally, other Jews thought that this is a very annoying and irritating, and everybody laughs at the whole thing, that this is your last prophet. Even it is suspected that his father is not his father. After 6 hours, the Roman governor and his soldiers were keeping the guard on the cave in which he was brought down from the cross. He allowed Jesus' followers to take him out of Judea. No resurrection happened, because even death did not happen. He was perfectly alive. Just few days it took for healing his hands and feet, which were nailed. And seeing the situation, any intelligent man will not go back to Judea. He also went in the search of one last try and ended up in Kashmir. Moses died in Kashmir, and after 2000 years, Jesus died, and their both graves are together there. Neither Jews want to recognize, nor Christians want to recognize. But it is so evident that on both the graves, the writing is in Hebrew. And in both the graves, the names of the persons, Moses and Jesus, are engraved. And a family that protects the graves is still Jewish. That is the only family in the whole Kashmir which Mohammedans did not convert to Mohammedanism. All other Jews were forced to become Mohammedans, but this family they left out because they were protecting and taking care of Moses and Jesus' grave. And because Mohammedanism also accepts Moses and Jesus as their prophets, so this family is the only family but no Pope goes there to look at the poor Jesus' grave. Neither Christians talk about it, neither Jews ever bother what happened to Moses, and Christians have no answer. Even if Jesus was resurrected, he must have died sometime afterwards. Where he has gone? Do they mean that he goes on resurrecting? Then he must be somewhere here. Because of all this suffering, Jews have found a way of laughing even in misery, and that way is the joke. The joke is purely a Jewish invention. And you should never do any change of names, because just changing the names won't help. A Jaina couple, it is impossible to say what the joke says. You know why I am knocking? Cries Harry, but you should see with what. No Indian will say that. It is just impossible. So I told Nirvanu that change the names. Put some Christian names, because Jews are being hit so much, and I love them. Half of my sannyasins are Jews, and most of them are my Jews because I am the only person who loves Jewish jokes. They have a flavor which is their own. Countries like India are very serious. To tell a joke, Indians will feel very much hurt. They are such a repressed people. here there are few of my old friends who are jainas. I told Nirvanu, do you want them also to go? Hearing the joke about Halwa Bhai and Meva Bhai, then they are not going to come. The people who are translating my books from English to Hindi continuously send me notes that what to do about jokes. And the people who are translating my Hindi books into English, they again and again ask me what to do with the poetry. So I tell them, if you can manage translate the poetry in prose, if you cannot, then just leave it out. And to the people who are translating from English to Hindi, I say simply, you cannot do anything except leaving those jokes. Indians will get absolutely mad. They are already mad about me. Such a seriousness has been a long sickness, a wound that has not healed. Jews have certainly proved their mettle in all their agony. They have maintained their laughter, they have not lost it. But it is a strange psychology that the people who are in suffering will always love laughter. That gives at least some time to forget the misery. People who have lived peacefully, no suffering, don't know what laughter is. I have been thinking many times that I should speak on the psychology of jokes. And it has so many implications that why a certain joke is a joke and why it arose. Who were the people, who must have been the people who managed that joke? In what background the joke flowered, was refined, because it is centuries' work. A single joke can be traced back to centuries, and you will find little differences happening, and finally it comes to a perfection. It is an art work, but it needs a certain climate and a certain understanding and a certain openness, a certain unrepressed joyfulness. Otherwise, it can backfire. It is a beautiful joke, but Nirvana is not a Jew. She thought it better to make it Christian, because she knows better the Christian names, and she knows better the festival of Lent. In a Jewish context, it would have been even more better, because they are the most unrepressed people in the world. It is not a coincidence that Sigmund Freud, a Jew, started a new science, psychoanalysis. The whole science is against repression. Every joke has a long history and background. It will be good sometime to give the whole series to Sardar Gurdayal Singh and find out the roots of these jokes, their psychology, the people, because there are many people. For example, Jews tell jokes about themselves. They are intelligent people. Other people tell jokes about the Polacks. They are the very unintelligent people. They cannot make a joke themselves. That is impossible. But they are good in a way. They allow the whole world to make jokes about them. Nice guys. Nevedana. clearly. Close your eyes and feel your body to be completely frozen. Now look inwards. Gather all your consciousness as a sphere piercing towards the very center of your being. Deeper and deeper, and you are bound to find the life fire. This fire does not burn. This fire is cool. This fire is like flowers. These flames are your eternal divine sources. At this moment you are the Buddha. Take care of the Buddha 24 hours. Cultivate the Buddha 24 hours. Not for a single moment forget to remember your Buddhahood. As your remembrance deepens, as your awareness becomes clear, as you dissolve into your witnessing, the Buddha spontaneously arises in your actions, in your words, in your silences. He becomes your whole life. And a life of great joy, a life of blessings, a life which is pure poetry, essential music, an eternal dance. But keep the witness clear, because in your whole body only the witness is eternal. Everything is mortal. Sooner or later it will be in some grave. It has come from the earth, it will go back to the earth. Only the witness will fly without leaving its footprints into the blue sky, to become part of the cosmos. Buddha is simply a name for your witnessing. To make it clear, Nivedana, relax, witness the body is lying there almost dead. The mind is there, maybe chattering a little bit, but you are not it. You are simply a watcher. In this moment, you are at the greatest peak of your consciousness and also the greatest depth. Thousands of flowers are showering on you. In this silence, in this serenity, the evening has become tremendously beautiful. Before Nivedana calls you back, collect as many flowers as much fragrance as much juice of your life and persuade the Buddha to come with you. He has been hiding in the center for centuries. Bring him to the circumference. The world needs it. This is the right moment for every Buddha to come out. That is the only hope for the whole planet. If Buddhas can come out on their circumference, in their daily activities, we can change the very fabric of human life on the earth. It can become a benediction. Man has lived uncivilized for a single reason, that he never went deep into himself. I call only those people civilized who have reached to their center and who have seen themselves as Buddhas. Nivedana, come back. But so even in your coming back, the grace, the silence, the joy, the blissfulness of this moment sit for a few moments just to recollect the golden path you have traveled, and the strange man Buddha that you have found, not as a separate entity from you, but just as your innermost being, your very soul. Thank you.